for argument is 17-1448, Maycomb Technology v. Infineon. Before we begin, I just wanted to address the council question, just to make sure we're all on the same page with respect to confidentiality and what we can and can't talk about here and otherwise. And it gets a little confusing because there's a lot of confidential marking in the appendices, but it seems to me, so I want you to clarify if I'm wrong, that there's pretty close to very little, if anything, in the briefs themselves. And most particularly, what I'm interested in is the whether or not it's non-confidential for us to refer to the agreement itself and the various provisions, which some of which are incorporated in the injunction.
That's fine. It's MACOM's position that the entirety of the license agreement can be public. Infineon had a different view.
Yes, Your Honor. The terms of the license agreement are confidential under the confidentiality provisions in the license agreement, and so the definitions we have asked to be kept confidential.
What did you, I mean, I'm looking at blue here, and I've got the confidential version, but I looked at the non-confidential version, and I didn't see anything that was extracted.
Yes, section 2.1 is not confidential, so that's the focus in the briefs, is the language of section 2.1. The definitions of exclusive field, That's confidential.
Oh, I saw those marked, I think, in red, but I didn't see reference. Are those contained in your brief?
I don't believe they're contained in the brief, Your Honor.
I'm sorry, you said?
I do not believe they're contained in the brief,
Your Honor. Yeah, okay. So what we've got here is, as I said, I didn't see any particular markings here, but there are confidential markings in the appendices, which go way beyond, I mean, stuff that you've let out publicly here is marked confidential in the appendices. Do you understand what I'm talking about? But the agreement is all open, right? Okay. All right. Thank you. Sorry. Won't be counted against your time, Mr. Wiley. Why don't you come up and proceed?
May it please the court, David Willey for the Infineon entities. I would like to begin with the duty of good faith, followed by irreparable harm, and then the issues with respect to paragraphs 3 and 4 of the injunction. The district court erred by relying upon what it described as a consensus rule. The courts may not imply a covenant not to exceed the scope of a patent license unless the license includes a technology transfer. This was error because there is no consensus rule. The case law relied upon by the district court and by MACOM before this court applied a different legal standard, a different legal doctrine than the one advanced by Infineon on appeal. The cases relied upon by MACOM and the district court concern implied in fact covenants. The duty of good faith and fair dealing, which is the subject of this appeal, is a covenant implied in law, and it is error to conflate the two doctrines. By calling it a consensus rule, the district court has conflated the two doctrines. These two doctrines are based upon different policy considerations and have different legal requirements. So it is error to blend them together rather than focusing on the legal requirements for each separately. There are some fundamental differences between these legal doctrines. First, implied in fact covenants may or may not exist in a particular case. The implied duty of good faith and fair dealing, however, and implied a law covenant exists by operation of law in every California contract.
You ask us at page 33 of the blue brief to look at a Supreme Court a Vermont decision from 1966, which is cited with approval by other courts, none of which is binding or instructional to our circuit, for the purpose of establishing that proposition that the duty is found in every contract. Couldn't you come up with something better?
Well, Your Honor, this issue just doesn't arise very often.
The implied duty of good faith?
The implied duty of good faith in this context. I think what is important about the Vermont decision is that the policy underlying the duty of good faith and fair dealing is the same in Vermont as it is in California. And so we submit that the California courts would treat the issue similarly.
But just to be clear, you weren't able to find any California cases that address this issue.
Well,
it is California state law that would apply. I understand your position that, you know, there are a number of cases that hint around this, some going one way, some going the other in various different jurisdictions. But what's your best case to support your position in California?
Okay, we cited a district court case, a copyright case, where the court recognized an implied obligation not to interfere with the copyright. But Your Honor, the best case in California really is the Carrier case that lays out the standard for the duty of good faith and fair dealing. That case says that a party can't do something to interfere with the other party's rights to enjoy the benefits of the agreement, considering the nature and purpose of the contract and the legitimate expectations of the parties. The Shaw case in Vermont found that the legitimate expectations of the parties when they enter into a license with a field of use limitation is that the licensed party will not go outside that field of use limitation.
One of the things that distinguishes your case between some of the other cases that talk about this, including Shaw, is that in this situation, you're talking about JAN on SI, okay, Silicon, right? And then it seems that that's what the license agreement is directed to. There's no mention at all of using the substrate silicon carbide. And so as far as a field of use goes, I mean, I think those other cases are talking about, for example, you can use the technology in California, but you can't use it in Maine or something like that. Whereas this, the field of use that you seem to be talking about might be one that I can't even tell if it's actually within the license itself at all, because it seems that the technology that the license is talking about is this silicon technology, not silicon carbide.
Okay. Several responses, Your Honor. First of all, the field of use limitation in Shaw was regarding the size of the filaments. So it is similar in that there was a technological field of use limitation. The context of this transaction presents a stronger case for the violation of the duty of good faith and fair dealing. The context of this transaction is that MACOM's predecessor owned these patents. They were sold to Infineon's predecessor for $9 million with a carefully negotiated field of use, licensing the technology back to MACOM in a limited field of use, with ongoing obligations to cooperate in patent prosecution and enforcement. So the parties knew well what gallium nitride on silicon carbide was and what gallium nitride on silicon was, and carefully limited the license to gallium nitride on silicon. The patents that are at issue in this case and that were licensed talk about both gallium nitride and silicon and gallium nitride and silicon carbide. So the parties were well aware of silicon carbide when they entered into this license agreement.
I know you wanted to talk about this and irreparable harm, et cetera, but your time's running out, so let me turn to what I'd like you to talk about.
Okay.
Firstly, what is the status of the injunction, or what is the status of the case now before the district court?
The status of the case before the district court is that discovery has begun. With respect to the injunction, there was a contempt motion that was filed, and we just had a hearing on contempt. That actually is relevant to one of the issues before the court, which is whether or not the injunction satisfies the requirements of Rule 65.
And what about, there's no trial scheduled or anything of that on the merits?
There is a trial scheduled, yes, Your Honor.
For?
I believe it is early 2019.
So let me turn to 65D, which was the issue I wanted to focus on. Why, your challenge is to paragraph 3, right?
Yeah, paragraphs 3 and 4, Your Honor.
Wait. Well, where's your challenge to paragraph 4?
Well, the challenge is based upon the language about practicing the patents, that we're not allowed to do certain things, make, use, sell, et cetera, with regard to practicing the patents.
I'm sorry, is that an answer to paragraph 4?
No, the requirement about practicing the patents appears in paragraphs 3 and 4. Our contention is that that language violates this court's prior decision, the IXYS case, which basically...
I'm looking at paragraph 4. What in paragraph 4 implicates? Yeah. Because I didn't understand. I thought the challenge, the 65D challenge was really the paragraph
3. The 65D challenge focuses on paragraph 3,
okay,
which prohibits us from doing certain things and practicing the patents and doing those things.
Right, right. So can you talk to us a little about your argument in that regard? Because I think the other side makes the argument, hey, we've got wrongful termination. If we assume that the district court was correct on her analysis of likelihood of success and irreparable harm, what's wrong with the injunction just incorporating the terms of the wrongfully terminated agreement and including the language there?
Okay, because this court's prior decisions have found that even after there has been claim construction, a trial on the merits before a jury, and an adjudication of infringement of a discrete product, it violates Rule 65 to enjoin a party from infringing the patent going forward. Because there may be other disputes with a product that is not colorably different from the product that was tried.
Is this a different kind of case, though? This is not a patent infringement case. None of this ensued. Isn't this a different kind of case? And therefore, should we be looking at our jurisprudence with regard to the scope of injunctions in infringement cases, or should we be looking to a different analysis, given that this was a wrongful termination and all the district court is saying is, again, assuming that she's right on irreparable harm and likelihood of success, you've got to follow this contract?
Yeah, it's not a different kind of case in this sense, and in fact, this is worse than the typical kind of case. In the cases that this court has decided, there has been an adjudication, there has been claim construction, there is a product. Here, there are 39 patents, no adjudication about what any of the terms mean, and no product was analyzed. So essentially, we've been told, don't infringe any of these 39 patents, but I'm not going to tell you what the claims mean. And I think what happened with the contempt motion below is perfect evidence that this was not a clear injunction under Rule 65. The court decided that to decide the contempt motion would require it to do claim construction and decided to postpone analyzing the contempt motion until it had done claim construction as well as until it had heard from this court. That is evidence that the injunction was vague. If the injunction set forth clearly what we were prohibited from doing, the court wouldn't need to do any claim construction to decide.
Well, wait, is the challenge the injunction is vague or that it's just overbroad?
Well, it doesn't clearly specify what we're prohibited from doing. That's the basis
for the vagueness argument raised in the briefs. I mean, I certainly see your overbreath argument, but...
Well, I, Your Honor, the violation of Rule 65 based upon this court's prior decision is that the injunction does not clearly prescribe the conduct which we are prohibited from doing.
Well, I think maybe the analysis you're shortcutting is because it's not explicit enough, then it's therefore overbroad. But in any event, well, you're into your rebuttal, so why don't we
okay,
go to
thank
the other
you,
side.
Good morning. May it please the court, Amanda Tesser for MACOM and Nitronix. This appeal relates to Infineon's attempts to walk away from the promises that it made to MACOM and Nitronix in 2010.
Can I just short-circuit you to pick up where your friend left off? Because, frankly, the 65D issue is the one that I'm struggling with the most.
Okay.
I only speak for myself.
Absolutely.
It does certainly seem to me that seeking contempt on the details that are included in paragraph 3 would clearly bump up against our precedent and would be arguably unworkable. So can you tell me why you would why your argument for justifying the scope of this injunction?
Absolutely. So as a starting point, remember that the district court in the Ninth Circuit has broad discretion to fashion equitable relief to remedy the irreparable harm.
Sure, okay.
Here, I think you said it and you hit it right on when you said, isn't this a different type of case? This is a different type of case because this is a contract case.
Yeah, I know, but if we're talking about contempt, couldn't infringement and breach of this implicate, we're talking about infringement. We're talking about not a breach of contract case necessarily, but really having to do the kind of analysis we do in our patent jurisprudence.
And we agree and acknowledge that to prove contempt, we do have to show that they're practicing one of the patents. That being said, I think it's too high of a standard to require the district court to have laid out claim constructions for 39 patents.
That may not be the solution to the problem. The solution to the problem may be this is just overbroad at this stage of the case.
We don't believe that
They couldn't possibly, even if you laid out every claim in the patents, if they come up with a new product tomorrow, that product could arguably be subject to contempt proceedings under this injunction, right?
If it practices one of the patents. I think
I ask a question relatedly.
Yes.
It seems that you've shown a likelihood of success that your client didn't breach the contract, right?
My client didn't breach the contract?
There's a likelihood of success that there's been no breach and therefore Infineon must honor its obligations under the contract. That's what you showed, right?
That's correct.
Okay. That's what you showed likelihood of success on. Have you showed likelihood of success that they are infringing?
No, we have not.
No, you did not. So why does your injunction get to prevent them from infringing?
It's because of the way the contract was drafted here. So they own these patents. There are 3 dozen patents that they have owned for the past 7 years that they have been prosecuting, that they understand, that they wanted to own, because everyone understands that these are foundational patents. Everybody understands, and it's within the context of the record, that there is no commercially feasible way to get around these patents. They haven't denied that. They've contested that we haven't put in evidence on that point, and it's correct that we did not put in an expert report on that point, but they haven't actually affirmatively denied that. And in the context of the contempt proceedings,
just backing up for a minute.
Yeah.
I want to get you back to Judge Prost's question because I'm afraid I diverted you.
Yeah.
One thing is you mentioned that the district court has great discretion to have an injunction. I agree that there's discretion on whether to grant an injunction, but isn't compliance with Rule 65D reviewed de novo?
That is correct, but I will also say that they haven't cited a single case in the context of contract law out of the Ninth Circuit or anywhere else that has said that this kind of injunction in a contract, a license case, is improper. They've only cited authority from the Federal Circuit that's arisen in the context of patent cases. And I think it's fundamentally different when you
What's your best case on your side?
I would say the best case on our side is probably the Boardman case, which is a case where the Ninth Circuit enjoined conduct that the enjoined party argued was actually allowed by a contract, but the court said, the Ninth Circuit said, that that conduct amounted to effectively preparing to do something that was enjoined.
Let's talk about the elephant and the dancing hippopotami lining the back of the room, which is to say, the next case.
Yes.
And leaving aside whether the court acted improperly because the matter was on appeal, the court took certain action. And if we determined that that was properly before the court, what do you think about that action the court took, leaving aside the propriety of the court doing it, opposed to us sending it back down and having it done over again?
Setting aside the jurisdictional issue, we think, let me say this, the parties have both said that Section 2.1 is unambiguous. We just read it very, very differently. And in California, the test is what they do is, and we all read the case in the law school, the Pacific Gas and Electric case, what they do is the judge kind of takes a peek at the parole evidence to see if there's a latent ambiguity in the contractual provision, to see if there's something in it that would lend itself to a meaning that would be different than the plain and ordinary meaning of the words. And if the district court concludes that there is a latent ambiguity, then they admit the parole evidence and analyze it. Here, we submit that, setting aside those jurisdictional issues,
right,
if you get to the full record, we submit that the Section 2.1 is unambiguous and that you cannot simply read out that language in the first sentence that talks about how the exclusive license is exclusive, including as against IR. And the reading that Infineon gives to Section 2.1 completely eviscerates those words. The parties here, we think, pretty clearly knew how to spell it out specifically when IR was retaining some right. That's the beginning of the second sentence, where they say, notwithstanding the foregoing, IR retains the right under the license patents to design, develop, make, so forth, in the field of use. So the suggestion that they would then immediately, in the second part of that sentence, take away rights by silence and not specifically say what IR was retaining, to us is not credible, and it can't be read that way. We read that second sentence about the notwithstanding part to clarify the somewhat unusual and what would otherwise be perhaps confusing relationship between the field of use and the exclusive field. And I think that, you know, we submitted a diagram, a graphic on page 8 of our red brief. We read that language in the notwithstanding section as being designed to clarify that relationship between the blue, the ring, the donut that goes around that green exclusive field in the middle.
The elephant I see is different. So can I bring you back to paragraph 3 of the injunction?
Absolutely.
Okay. What happens I thought he was going to say what happens the next case, which was not your next case, but the next case that comes before the district court in contempt. You could be dealing with a product that hasn't been on the market yet. Some new product a designer on goes on the market next month, and you say it infringes one of the 35 patents, we don't know which one of them. And that is supposed to be adjudicated in the context of a contempt proceeding? Really? Is there, I mean, maybe you have an example of when that's happened before, but certainly in patent world, I don't recall ever seeing a kind of contempt proceeding that does that. And in fact, that's, I think it's exactly that reason that results in our case law saying, no, 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 this is not the way we run contempt here.
So what I will say is that the order that we proposed to the court didn't include that language about practicing the Nitronix patent. It's our view that you can't do GaN on silicon in a commercially feasible way without practicing them. Infineon asked that that language be added, and the court added it during that period of time last November when the parties were considering her proposed order.
I appreciate that, but I don't. That doesn't do me any good because we're left here adjudicating. You are here defending paragraph 3, and they are here challenging paragraph 3. So that's what we're left with.
Well, that's fair, but it's also fair to say that they asked for that language to be added, so now for them to challenge the injunction because they got what they wanted puts us in a little bit of an untenable position. We would have preferred that that language not be there and that they be prohibited from operating in our exclusive field at all as a blanket statement.
Oh, so this was a limiting... In that context of the fight we were having, that was limiting. But you're not suggesting that they waived their right to challenge the breadth of paragraph 3 in this injunction, right?
No. Okay. No, we are not suggesting that. Did you want to hear about the Shaw case and the good faith and fair dealing?
Sure.
Did you look in the restatement? I'm just curious.
Did we look? I'm sure we did. I don't recall what the answer was. I don't think there was anything particularly on point, although I don't remember off the top of my head, so I don't want to, you know, say that firmly.
I seem to remember it being in there, but...
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Well, let me say this. There is a very well-developed body of case law in California about the covenant of good faith and fair dealing. And what everyone here agrees is that covenant, when you use the implied... covenant of good faith and fair dealing, it has to be hinged on a particular contractual term. The point of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing is that the promises that you make have to be executed in good faith. So if I promise to one of you that I'll mow your lawn and you're going to give me some money for it, and I come in and I cut off a centimeter and you look at it and can't tell anything's been done, you can say, hey, you need to perform here. I've been deprived of the benefit of my bargain because we both understood that you were going to be mowing my lawn for real. You can't imply from the promise to mow the lawn that you're going to do something else, that you're going to trim the trees or paint the garage. What has happened here in this case is that there's patent license. And at its core, a patent right is the right to exclude. That's 35 U.S.C. 154. And what a patent license is the waiver of a right to sue. And so when I say to you, I license you to practice these patents, what I'm saying is I won't sue you when you practice these patents. And when the promise is I license you in the field of use only, and that's the new hinge that they've hooked onto, that was never argued below. There was nothing about the word only that was the focus of the court's briefing or decision below. When I say I promise not to sue you in the field of use only, that doesn't imply I'm not going to sue you when you operate outside the field of use. If anything, it implies the opposite. And here, when you look at the use of the word only within the context of Section 2.1, it's actually used twice. IR says that they give a worldwide royalty-free exclusive license in the field of use only, and also in the exclusive field only. And I think when read in context and considered in the entirety of this somewhat confusing relationship that they were setting up with the different fields and the overlapping fields, I think it's pretty clear that the use of the word only there was designed to distinguish and point out and remind the reader, hey, we're talking about the field of use here in Part A. Hey, we're talking about the exclusive field here in Part B.
Your adversary, I'm not even sure that this is particularly relevant, but yeah. I'm curious. Your adversary suggests that the patent portfolio covers not just silicon substrates, but also silicon carbide substrates. Do you agree?
That the patents?
The patent portfolio.
The patent portfolio. I think there are some in the portfolio that can be read to cover it. I don't know off the top of my head if those had issued already as of 2010. They may or may not have.
Okay.
So I don't know that was top of mind. What I will tell you was that the relationship between Itronix and IR for many years had involved only GaN on silicon, and that was the focus of the 2004 agreement and the 2010 agreement. The other thing that I would say is that, you know, thinking ahead to kind of the what would be the ramification of adopting their argument that it's a per se breach of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing every time you exceed the scope of a license, it is incredibly common for big companies to cross-license other companies in a particular geography, to a particular part of their patent portfolio, to a particular field of use. And when you have two big companies, you know, Apple and Samsung, IBM and Dell, whoever it is, who have these cross licenses, all of a sudden, if somebody steps one step over the field of use that they're the geography or the whatever it is that they're granted, all of a sudden, if that becomes grounds for termination because it's a breach of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing every time.
And instead, it's your position that it's simply a patent infringement suit.
Exactly. The patent laws provide a full remedy here. There's no reason to extend contract law in the way they're describing. They point to the Shaw case, which is obviously, as you recognize, a Vermont case from 1966. There have been a lot of cases since then. Well, a lot would be a stretch, but there have been half a dozen cases since then that could easily have followed this implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing reasoning. None of them have. And you can say that the law is in disarray, but those cases really all hang together remarkably well. They all say if there's an expressed negative covenant, you enforce it. There's not one here. They all say you can imply one in fact if there's been a technology transfer that has enabled the licensee to go beyond the scope. That's not here. And they're correct that Shaw is the only one that then has gone on to consider the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing, but the other ones could have and didn't. And that would have been an easier path in some of them to the resolution that came out. And so I think that it's fair to say that this would be a substantial expansion of the law to adopt their argument.
Your time has expired.
Okay. It says I have 30 seconds, but I will sit down.
No, that's over the expired.
Sorry. Thank you.
Thank you.
So one thing on the injunction, Your Honor, because counsel said that we asked for the provision about the patents to be put in.
Yeah, I was going to ask for clarification about that.
You know, that's like an inviting error argument, but they don't really make an inviting error argument. It would have been error not to include some limitation on the patents in the injunction, because what the district court was enjoining us from was violating the exclusive license provision, which required practice of the patent. So the broader injunction would have been an error. And in the same brief where we said you can't just enjoin us from practicing in the exclusive field, because they even said we could do that as long as we didn't infringe the patents. So you can't just say we can't practice in the exclusive field. It has to be cabined to the patents. But we also argued in the same brief that that injunction still would violate Rule 65 because it prescribes us from practicing patents, and that violates the specificity requirement of Rule 65.
Tonight, for clarification, are you saying that the injunction, the third paragraph, should be deleted in entirety, or should it be modified?
It should be deleted in its entirety.
That's what I thought you were saying.
Yeah, what we had argued in the district court is that it would have been error to give an even broader injunction, because all the license agreement proscribes is violating their exclusive patent license. They wanted to say we couldn't sell products in the exclusive field whether they violated the patents or not. Okay. A couple responses to some points that counsel raised on the duty of good faith and fair dealing. Not every state has the duty of good faith and fair dealing, number one. Number two, the parties here chose California law. California law in the duty of good faith and fair dealing and implied in law covenant looks more at fairness, fundamental fairness and good faith, than do other states. Yes, in these other cases, maybe the parties could have raised good faith and fair dealing, but they didn't. So those cases aren't really relevant to the question before the court. That's not the legal theory we are espousing. We are espousing the duty of good faith and fair dealing, which is an implied in law covenant. Second point I want to make is that the California case law, counsel referred to this textual hook argument. Two clarifying points there. Number one, the California law does not require the implied duty of good faith and fair dealing to violate a particular contractual provision. The Carrier case makes very clear that the obligations are imposed by law based upon the expectations of the parties due to the purpose of the contract, not particular provisions within the contract, the purpose of the contract overall. That is why Shaw found a violation for the same reason. The expectations of the parties were that the parties wouldn't go outside the field of use. The second point is the textual hook. They keep saying, well, this only argument that we're making is new on appeal. It is not new on appeal. What we argued below was that the text of the contract, which led to the violation of the duty in good faith and fair dealing, was the field of use limitation, which is the same basis that the Shaw court found the implied duty of good faith and fair dealing was violated under the same policy that California follows. So that was the basis for our argument, not the only language in the contract. The only language is simply an additional argument in favor of our position, which is perfectly acceptable under CCS Fitness. Thank you.
Thank you.